Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hey there, and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says ice and silence and dark skies as we go around another year. I'm Jonathan Strickland.
I'm Lauren Volkebaum.
I'm Joe McCormick. That kind of put me in a moody mood.
A melancholy mood?
Yeah.
That song, I don't normally talk about the lyrics I pick, but in this case I'm going to. That song is called I'm Your Moon. It's by Jonathan Colton, and it's about Pluto and Charon.
Aww.
And it's Charon singing to Pluto after Pluto has been downgraded from planet to dwarf planet.
Aww.
And saying, it's all right, I'm still here with you, and we're revolving around each other.
You know, that's the thing. When people get upset about Pluto not being a planet anymore, I'm like, what's wrong with being a dwarf planet?
Yeah.
It's kind of insulting to Ceres and all these other dwarf planets that are pretty cool.
Well, I think Colton's point was that the designation was almost created for Pluto, and therefore that's why it's an insult. Like, we're not calling you that anymore. We're calling you this new thing that you are, and nothing else that we've classified yet is. But the reason why we chose that lyric, or why I chose that lyric in the first place...
Yeah, act like we have any say in this.
Whenever I'm not here, you guys pick lyrics.
That's true.
But We are going to cover New Horizons, the probe that has gone on this amazing mission to Pluto, the flyby of Pluto, and to talk about everything that went into making that mission possible, as well as the some of the science that we've learned so far, knowing that we've got so much more to learn from this mission. And it's really just a cool story.
It's amazing that I grew up learning about Pluto as one of the planets
in
our solar system in my science books. And I remember, you know, learning all the names of the planets and thinking about Pluto as just another one of them. But I think I didn't realize when I was a kid how we had never gotten a close look at Pluto.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. And I mean, depending on when you were learning about it, I don't think that we had any concept about even what the atmosphere of the planet looked like until 1988.
Yeah, so when I was a kid going to school, we didn't know anything about Pluto's atmosphere.
Yeah, they were just making it up. They were just like, "Hey, so there's this planet called Pluto out there."
Yeah. Yeah, it's
totes out there, y'all.
And you know, it's
probably icy.
Pretty young in our scientific knowledge. Like if you look at you know, when we learned of these different planets, the discovery of Pluto dates back to 1930.
Oof.
Discovered by Clyde Tombaugh, who named, you know, was able to discover this planet, which got him a great deal of fame in astronomical circles.
Who was Clyde?
Clyde was an interesting guy, very eccentric astronomer, very he loved puns. So I think I would have gotten along with Clyde really well.
Uh-huh.
Smart
Are
smart guy.
Non-eccentric astronomers? Is that a...
I mean,
subcategory of the field.
There could be some who are just very, you know, very middle of the road kind of astronomers. I don't know. I think of astronomers as being dreamers, so I often think of them as being eccentric.
No, yeah. I'm sure you have your astronomical accountants, the people who their favorite part of the job is logging the coordinates of the new object.
Right.
And creating new spreadsheet mechanisms to sort the data.
Naming those objects a non-sequential series of
I dub thee CR1059.AR4.
You're so droll. So Tombaugh discovered Pluto, but later on we would discover much more about this, that it has five moons that we know of. There may be more, the largest of which is Charon, which is more than half the size of Pluto if you're going by diameter. There's also Styx, Nix, Kerberos, and Hydra.
We got a lot of hellish names going on here.
The idea being that when you come out from interstellar space and you start entering into the solar system, you first pass through the outer realm, the hellish outer
realm.
You've
got to go through hell to get to us.
Huh. Kind of.
You know, it's the icy mouth of Satan out there.
To be fair, the idea of the underworld and the area beyond life in Greek mythology doesn't have quite the same connotation.
Not necessarily a place of punishment
or
so forth.
Right.
But we do get these like sort of like negative afterlife kind of feelings. We got Pluto, he's the god of the dead, right?
And you know, a lot of very popular depictions of that character cast him in a villainous or malevolent light.
Yeah, was he in the Disney Hercules movie?
He was the Hades was
the guy with the
Hades.
Fire hair.
Played by James Wood.
Yeah.
Thank you.
But definitely the equivalent to Pluto, yes.
Okay, so you got Pluto, you got Styx, that's the river you have to cross to get to the underworld.
Also
right?
An amazing arena band.
Right, there you go. And then Charon is the ferry operator who gets you across the river Styx, right?
Who you have the coins that you have to have so that he will ferry you across, yep.
Now I don't know quite about the other ones.
Oh, Kerberos? That's,
No, I don't know.
Okay, well... Hydra. Hydra's the multi-headed.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I know that one.
All right. You know that one.
Hail Hydra.
Hail Hydra. You know.
I don't know what you guys are talking about.
Kerberos, that's the Greek pronunciation for, we often will make it a soft C, Cerberus, the three-headed dog.
Oh, there
okay.
You go.
Okay.
So, yeah, it's a, and by the way, I have a friend from high school who is, very knowledgeable in Greek mythology. And if he's listening to this episode, I do apologize for butchering the pronunciation of all these names because I know I am. But these were discovered later on. And this was really the New Horizons mission was really our first chance to get a close look at these various bodies. Before we had a lot of pretty blurry images from various telescopes.
Oh, yeah. If you Googled images of Pluto just a couple months ago, you would get artists illustrations, but then you'd also get a photograph from the Hubble telescope that was basically a disc of yellow and black blurs.
Yeah, it's funny because NASA's actually released a series of photos that have been taken over time of Pluto, so you can actually see our view of Pluto improving.
Evolve, yeah, over the years.
It's really impressive. But before we get into the actual mission, I thought I'd talk a little bit, just kind of a quick overview of the history of planetary exploration using probes, because it kind of tells you, you know, how difficult this problem was and why it took so long for us to get a close look at Pluto.
Yeah. Also, just to put in real quick, because we forgot one of these moons, Nyx is the goddess of the night.
Oh, oh. Right. I didn't mention Nyx. Thank you very much.
Stevie Nyx, the goddess of the night.
Similar. I think they're related.
So, yeah.
I think it's one of those weird Zeus things.
We got Styx and Nyx. That's awesome.
Just wanted to put in. Don't want to forget anybody out there.
I just like that we've got a real rockin' episode so far. All right. So
just like the wild wind.
All right. No, I'm not going to go down that route. So the first successful mission, a flyby mission using a probe, would be back in 1962 with the Mariner 2. That went by Venus. So it was the first time we sent a probe on a flyby mission of another planet. And it was the first mission to perform a successful flyby, but it wasn't our first try. As humanity's first try. It wasn't the first one. The first try was with the Soviet Union in 1961 with the Sputnik 7 probe that was meant to land on Venus, but it never escaped Earth orbit. So,
yeah.
Well, I mean, this story happens over and over for both the Soviets and for the United States. I mean, this was during the space race, right?
No, I'm not making fun. I mean, obviously, there's
a lot of
hard to do
sad trombone noises that would go along with the rest of this section here.
Yeah. And other attempts that would follow Sputnik 7, but were also unsuccessful were the Venera 1 and the Mariner 1 and the Sputnik 19 probes. And it wouldn't be until Mariner 2 that we actually got a good look at Venus. Next came Mars, actually. So we didn't go to Mercury next. We went to Mars. And that was the Mariner 4 as the first successful flyby probe. That was in 1964.
And I believe it was on July 14th of 1964, which happens to be the same date that we achieved this Pluto flyby.
Cool. That's an interesting coincidence. Other attempts to get to Mars included Mariner 3, Sputniks 22 and 24, and the Mars 1 and Marsnik 1 and 2 probes. Actually, those two had been launched back in 1960, so if Marsnik 1 and 2 had been successful, they would have actually preceded the Venus flyby, but they were not successful. Then we checked out Mercury in 1973 with the Mariner 4. Voyager 1 and 2 flew by Jupiter and Saturn in 1977. Voyager 2 would also go by Uranus and Neptune. So we had looks at all the other planets, but Pluto remained so far out there that we had not had a chance to check it out. And so we launched the New Horizons probe way back in 2006, so it took more than 8 years for it to go from Earth to Pluto. And it's funny because it almost didn't happen. We almost didn't have a New Horizons project. And if it had not happened when it did, we would have had a really long wait ahead of us to give it another go. So NASA had been debating on a Pluto mission for decades, and one of the proposed missions was called the Pluto Kuiper Express back in 2000. Kuiper referring to the Kuiper Belt, which is sort of like the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter, but much bigger and on the very outskirts of our solar system.
Icy objects way, way out there.
Yeah, lots of frozen, not just water ice, but methane and other hydrocarbons. So the budget for this proposed mission just kept growing as time went on. Things were getting tagged on. This was during a pretty rough period during NASA's history.
This was during a lot of the space shuttle trouble and stuff like that.
Yeah, and budget cuts. They were facing big budget cuts, and there were budget plans that were proposed that didn't have money set aside specifically for missions like this, which also caused a problem. But eventually NASA ended up canceling this project when it just got too complicated and too expensive. And that prompted the NASA Associate Administrator, Ed Wyler, to say that the plans to visit Pluto were officially dead for the foreseeable future. And here is why. So Pluto's got a really enormous orbit, right?
Gigantic.
Yeah.
And not exactly as close to circular as many of the other orbits.
Right.
Yeah, it kind of dips in and out.
Yeah, it's kind of what we might call an eccentric orbit.
Yeah.
And if NASA didn't get a spacecraft on the way to Pluto within a few years of 2000, while it was as most interesting, we would miss that opportunity.
Well, but most interesting, aren't planets always kind of interesting?
No, they're always kind of interesting. But some can be more interesting than others, and some can be more interesting at one time of the year than another. For example, when Pluto is closer to the sun, its atmosphere is gaseous.
Or so we suspected.
So we suspected. But when it moves further out, scientists were worried that the temperature of the planet would become so cold that the atmosphere itself would freeze and fall to the ground. So you imagine, like, if you've ever seen any of those cartoons or anything where someone says something and their words freeze in the air and then fall.
And just clatter, yeah.
It's kind of like that, but for realsies.
That, yeah. I feel like I have felt cold before, but I don't think, I think I need to redefine.
Yeah, you know, we're talking like, you know, seriously cold here where things that would be in gas form here on Earth would be solid there on Pluto. So we wanted to be able to look at Pluto when its atmosphere would still be in atmospheric form. But because of that enormous orbit, we would only have a certain window of opportunity. Pluto takes 247.68 Earth years to go around the sun once. And if we missed that point or that range where the atmosphere would remain in gas form, as far as we could tell, then we'd have more than two centuries to wait to try it again.
Ah.
And that's...
That's a really long-term budget plan even
yeah,
for NASA.
Exactly, so. Right. And then they'd be like, well, why bother planning anything? Because by the time we'd get around to launch, all the technology is going to be different anyway. So it was very disheartening to those who wanted to look at Pluto back in 2000 when this mission was canceled. In order to get to Pluto in time to check out this atmosphere, they had one other chance, which was to use one of the other planets in our solar system as kind of a boost.
Right. This is the Jupiter Gravity Assist. And
right.
New Horizons is not the only spacecraft that has used this.
Oh, that's correct.
We've talked about this a bunch on the show. It's basically when you get a probe or spacecraft near the orbit of something big enough to kind of let it be captured by the planet and then keep going. So it gets this forward boost by temporarily kind of riding in the slipstream of the planet almost.
Like
that skateboard in Back to the Future.
That's exactly what I was going to say. It's like when Marty gets on the back of the truck and uses the truck to accelerate on the skateboard much faster than his little toe push could ever get him.
Right. So the you might think, well, if we have Jupiter there, then what's the big worry? We can just use Jupiter. Well,
Jupiter orbits too.
Yeah, and Jupiter's orbit and Pluto's orbit aren't, you know, it's not like they're always in alignment. So you only have the amount of time where you can still correct for the trajectory you're going to get with the gravity assist so that you're still heading in the right direction so that you ultimately pass by Pluto. And the scientists had figured out that they needed to have this, they needed to have a launch before really January 2006 or right around there in order to take advantage of this. Now, it turns out that they actually got there a little later than that because the calculations weren't, they had kind of been conservative by saying, if we don't get there by January 2006, we don't get there at all.
Yeah.
Or if we don't launch by January 2006, there's no point in doing it. But the point was that they needed to launch from Earth because it was going to take time to go from Earth to Jupiter and then even more time, obviously, to go from Jupiter to Pluto. So they used this new idea. They kind of started pitching this around. And there was a new group formed in NASA to design a mission that would become New Horizons. And they estimated the cost would be $500 million, which would include the rocket needed to launch the spacecraft. So not just that the spacecraft would cost $500 million. They're saying the whole thing.
Not shabby.
Yeah, considering how we've talked so many times about how expensive getting stuff into space is. It's actually pretty decent, you know, as far as space missions are concerned. So they proposed this in 2001. There was a competitive mission pitch process where NASA was entertaining mission pitches from various parts of the organization. And NASA administration said, all right, let's fund this one. Let's see if we can make it happen. So the funding came from earmarks and budgets placed by members of Congress because the president, his budget plan did not cover anything that would go to this kind of mission. So in other words, it took an act of Congress in order to carve out parts of NASA's budget to allow this to happen. So New Horizons gets the funding it needs from this act of Congress, but there still were some other issues before it got to the point where it was doing a flyby of Pluto.
Well, yeah, I know it's had some onboard computer problems.
Yeah. Just after the gravitational assist from Jupiter, it had a computer issue.
Oh, that wasn't even the one I was talking about.
No, you were thinking of the one that was just before its flyby.
Yeah.
No, they had, so cosmic rays, we've talked about these before on the podcast.
Sure. High energy particles flying through space.
Yep. So they can cause computer glitches. Essentially it ends up being like a control alt delete thing. It's not like it destroys the computer, but it does necessitate a reboot. So there were cosmic rays that interfered with the computer, and at first the team had anticipated that it would only happen once in New Horizons mission. They thought that the cosmic rays were infrequent enough and space is huge that the odds were that New Horizons might encounter one. They kind of factored that in. It turned out that it encountered several more on its way to Pluto, and it was fine. It would reboot, everything was okay. So, no permanent damage was caused, but it did teach scientists something interesting. Like, wow, there's a little bit more of a chance of running into cosmic radiation than we had first anticipated.
Yeah, more of that activity. And that control-alt-delete kind of thing was also what wound up happening in the more recent computer shutdown.
Yes.
Yeah, that was very scary because we were right about to reach Pluto.
Yeah, we were like 10 days out.
Yeah.
Yeah, specifically what was happening was that the computer aboard the New Horizons was being asked to do two things at once, and it was the combination of the two what required
gave it Cartesian doubt.
It required too much computational power. It could not do both of them at once. So instead of trying to do both at once and possibly damaging itself in the process, it shut down, went to its backup computer. And so for a while, we didn't know. And phoned home. Yeah.
Phoned home to say, like, hey, help.
Yeah, exactly.
Don't know what to do about this one.
My main brain shut down. Can you guys look into that? And so, you know, obviously it takes a long time for information to get between the spacecraft and us.
Yeah, 4.5 hours was the time difference at like right then on that day.
So that's, you know, a significant delay between getting a message out and being able to reply. Then you have to wait another 4.5 hours for the reply to go out. And then you have to wait another 4.5 hours to see if it worked. But everything worked out fine. The engineers on the ground said, you know, this is exactly what the computer was supposed to do if this sort of thing happened. We know how to fix it. There were some reports, I would say, in the media that made it seem like the mission itself was in jeopardy. But all the engineers I was reading about, they were like, no, I mean, this was, you know, it obviously caused concern because of the timing.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But
And for that minute when, you know, they got the like help message at first, you know, before they could check back in with the computer, there was that moment of them going like, oh, well, is this another computer shutdown or did an asteroid destroy our spacecraft?
Right.
And no one had any idea for like another 4.5 to 9 hours.
There was always the chance that there could be a collision and that would have been the end of New Horizons.
Of the 496 planned observations, the shutdown prevented 30 of them from happening. So 6%, which sounds like a kind of large number until you kind of weight the importance of the observations by how close you actually are to the planet.
Yeah.
And this was still so far out, or relatively so far out, that it didn't do any irreparable harm to the mission.
Yeah. Most of the stuff I saw was like, it caused 30 of our observations to not happen, but they were 30 of the boring ones.
Yeah. Yeah.
No,
yeah.
It's all right.
It hadn't crossed over into the underworld yet.
No. It caused a few of our staff members to sleep on the floor of the APL that night.
Yeah.
But
so I thought we could talk a little bit about some of the instruments that are on the New Horizons. These are the things that are gathering the information, and they were purposefully made fairly simple. They decided not to go super elaborate and load this thing down with, you know, 100 instruments. There are only 7 aboard the spacecraft. And they have great names.
Are they also named after demonic entities from the underworld?
Yes. Ralph, the demonic entity from the underworld, is the first one. Quake in fear upon the approach of Ralph. Ralph may be what you do in the underworld. If you're at a certain level of the underworld, I recall lots of Ralphing in one of the levels of Dante's Inferno.
Yeah.
Ralph is a visible and infrared imager and spectrometer, and it is able to create thermal maps of surfaces and provide color and composition, enhancements to images. So a lot of the pictures that we see, by the time we see them, they've gone through a couple different layers of enhancements so that we can really make sense of what we're seeing. It's not what the raw data would normally represent. Then you have ALICE, which is an ultraviolet imaging spectrometer, and that's used to examine the composition of Pluto's atmosphere and can also search for an atmosphere around other bodies like Charon and Kuiper Belt objects, or KBOs. Then you have REX, the Radio Science Experiment. So why isn't it RSEX? Oh, wait, now I know. It's Radio Science Experiment, or REX, which measures atmospheric composition and temperature. It's a radiometer. Then you have LORI, LORRI, the Long Range Reconnaissance Imager, which is a camera with a really amazing telescopic lens. And that is what has been used to take pictures of Pluto's far side, the side that's facing away from us. And it also provides high-res images. Then you have SWAP, the Solar Wind Around Pluto. That's a spectrometer that analyzes solar wind and plasma. And it can also measure the escape rate of Pluto's atmosphere. We'll talk a little bit about Pluto's atmosphere in a second because that's really cool. Pepsi.
You can't do that.
What?
Oh, it's Pepsi.
Oh, it's 2 S's.
Completely different.
Yeah. There's
no trademark.
So Pluto.
Named after the ancient Scandinavian goddess of refreshing beverages.
Yeah. Yeah. Carbonation.
Out of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
From
if I'm
hell.
Not mistaken. Yeah. Again, no. Pluto Energetic Particle Spectrometer Science Investigation. That's what it stands for. It's an energetic particle spectrometer which measures the composition and density of plasma escaping Pluto's atmosphere. So similar to SWAP in that way. And then you have the SDC, the Student Dust Counter. It doesn't count student dust. It was designed by students to count dust. Okay. Yeah. So students designed this instrument, and it measures the space dust that New Horizons encounters throughout its voyage. So kind of cool. And so far, it's found tons of science.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Surprising things, too. Things we didn't expect to find.
Yeah.
Absolutely. The surface color data that we've started getting back indicates that there are three zones on Pluto, a kind of dark zone around the equator, then mid-colored zones around the mid-latitudes, and icy-looking zones in the polar regions, which the New Horizons team is guessing is the result of seasonal ice transport from the equator to the poles.
By ice transport, we don't necessarily mean like trucks taking ice.
Well, you know, I'm not counting anything out yet.
We're not talking about
snowpiercer here.
I've seen a lot of talk about the methane forming glaciers and glacial activity.
Yeah, the methane and nitrogen and carbon monoxide are forming glaciers because it is like negative 390 degrees Fahrenheit.
Yeah, very chilly out there. Yeah, super interesting. Also, there's that heart of Pluto region.
Right.
Yeah, so that's one of the big surface features everybody's been noticing
and
drawing cartoons about.
Yeah, yeah. This is vaguely heart-shaped. I've also seen several memes of the image of Pluto the cartoon dog superimposed on top of this particular region because from one angle it looks like you're looking at Pluto in profile.
Sure, yeah.
Pluto
the
dog.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's also the Pluto surface whale.
I've also seen it suggested that since there is, you know, no correct way up in space, that that we are looking at the Tuchus of Pluto.
Oddly enough, not the dark side of Pluto. This lighter colored region appears to be a concentration of carbon monoxide ice.
What?
Yeah, and it intensifies toward the center of that frozen area. So the concentration of carbon monoxide grows as you get toward the center of this mass.
But of course, the most scientifically remarkable thing about it is not that it is heart-shaped, but that it is so smooth. I mean, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, like Barry White.
One. Yeah. One of the odd things is that you would expect there to be a lot more indentations and craters.
Exactly.
Because you would expect, you know, Pluto was essentially, you know, kind of blasted by other materials, so we expected to see lots of pits and craters on the surface.
Like you do on the moon. Yeah.
And when you don't see that, then you start to have to ask yourself, why isn't it like that then? What is going on that means that, why don't we have these craters and pits?
Right. So it's typically been suggested, well, if we're looking at a smooth region on Pluto, that must mean that this region for some reason is geologically younger than we would expect any part of the surface of Pluto to be.
Yeah. In fact, the estimations are that the surface has been geologically active within the last 100 million years.
Ooh, that is nothing.
It's nothing on a geological scale. If for a planet, it's been around for 4 billion years.
In fact, I saw a report from Science magazine that said that the New Horizons team member John Spencer suggested it might even still be active today.
Which is pretty interesting. That's also where I think I've seen some of the mentions about glacial activity. And so we've got this one region that's informally called the Tombo region.
Within that Tombo region, there is a specific area of ancient cratered terrain where some of the craters have been filled in by very much younger ice. And they're calling this the Cthulhu Regio because they hate us and our ability to sleep.
Yeah, yeah. Cthulhu Fatagan. Yeah, and so much stuff about this is surprising to us. Mm-hmm. Getting back into the glaciers that we talked about, we mentioned that before with the carbon monoxide ice, the nitrogen ice, the methane ice.
Mm-hmm.
That's amazing. And that we don't really understand how all of these different land masses came about.
Right.
You know, that's a large mystery to us, too. So there are a couple of different hypotheses that we have about the various cracks and troughs that are on the surface of Pluto and how they might have formed. One is that maybe it was through contraction of the surface, which is like when you have a muddy area and then the sun comes out and it dries and you see those cracks form as the mud solidifies into dirt.
Oh, mm-hmm. Sure. Okay. So maybe the orbit of Pluto taking it back into the closer to the sun and letting some of these carbon monoxide glaciers melt.
Possibly. The other possible, you know, another hypothesis is convection, in which Pluto's interior would warm the frozen carbon monoxide. But that
of course, raises questions all on its own,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, right. Like, how would that happen?
One of the big lingering questions that's left by the new discoveries about Pluto is, if we assume that these surface features are explained by heat coming from the interior of Pluto, so geologic activity, convection, warming coming from the center of planet, where does that heat come from? Because we wouldn't expect it to be there.
I think it's love. this is why the scientists absolutely have been bubbling over with excitement, because mm-hmm. it's when you discover stuff and you don't know the answer to the question that really gets people, like, their imagination going, and they have to start coming up with ideas and then finding ways they might be able to test that.
Yeah, so I've read a few just proposed hypotheses. I mean, nobody knows the answer yet, but one of the ideas is that Pluto and its moon Charon were actually formed at a much more recent impact event than was previously thought. The idea is that they formed a long time ago when things were smashing together in the early solar system. You could explain them having more heat inside if they had formed much more recently than we expected.
Mm-hmm.
Another explanation would be if there are compounds present on Pluto and Charon with lower melting points than we would expect. Or you could maybe explain it in terms of tidal forces, but I think it's cool that we don't know the answer to this yet.
Yeah, no, it's great in the sense that it gives us goals, right? Like, now we know these observations, but now we have to explain mm-hmm. what caused the stuff we observed.
Yeah.
So pretty awesome. There are some other features on Pluto that we should talk about. There's some dark streaks across the plains of Pluto that suggest that wind could have been blowing material across the frozen surface. Also, the mountains on Pluto seem to be about 100 million years old or younger, similar to some of the other features we were talking about.
Mountain building, again, is evidence of geologic activity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And because of that lack of craters, again, that tells us, you know, generally how old they must be, because if they were older, we would expect to see a lot more craters on them.
Mm-hmm.
And normally we would say that a planet's mountains would be formed by some gravitational interaction between other planets that would generate the heat that would lead to major geological activity. But we have to kind of discount that for Pluto. It's too far out there for that to be a factor. So it's not like the forces that we understand that act upon other bodies don't necessarily pertain to Pluto. It's too small and too far away for that gravitational interaction to generate the heat necessary, at least as far as we understand. It may be that there's something going on that we had not factored in, and then we have to revise our ideas of what is possible, which is also super exciting. Then we can talk about Pluto's atmosphere, which was largely a mystery to us. You know, mm-hmm. this was the whole reason why we wanted to go when we went, because we wanted to make sure we could observe it while it was still in atmospheric form and not just chunks of ice on the ground.
Right.
So Pluto's atmosphere has been observed as far out as 1,000 miles or 1,600 kilometers from its surface, which was much further out than previous observations, which were around 170 miles or 270 kilometers. And it also contains a haze. There's this great image of Pluto from the far side of Pluto, where New Horizons has already gone past the planet, taking pictures back from the way it came.
Right, with sunlight kind of filtering through the atmosphere.
It looks like it's the cover.
Actually filtering.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was going to say, it looks like the cover of The Ring from the well, where you get that ring of
You're
light.
You're totally right. Yeah, it does.
But it's this haze that's around the planet, and that haze is really interesting. It's actually a couple of different complex hydrocarbons, like ethylene and acetylene, and those are byproducts. That's what remains from methane after it's been broken down by ultraviolet light. So
in the upper atmosphere of Pluto, you've got the solar radiation interacting with the atmosphere and smashing up those methane molecules.
Yeah.
And then, kind of dribbling this beautiful haze down onto the surface.
Exactly. It falls through the atmosphere of Pluto and condenses on the way down, and that's where we're getting this haze.
I think I read that's where Pluto's red color comes from, isn't it?
Yeah. It turns into this reddish-brown goop. And so
goop being the scientific term, yes.
Yeah, goop, goo, whatever you want, gunk. I mean, there are a lot of different words I could use. But at any rate, the hypothesis is, in fact, this is what gives Pluto that color. It may just be one contributing factor to that, actually. You know, we can't definitively say that that's the main reason or the only reason for the reddish coloration, but it seems to be contributing to it. And then scientists have been observing some fluctuations in Pluto's atmosphere, the changes in the atmospheric pressure, actually. There were earlier observations that were made where the pressure was at one level, but as New Horizons went by, it was much, much less. And scientists believe that, in fact, we are observing Pluto while it's undergoing a global change in atmosphere.
Yeah, yeah. The atmospheric pressure on the surface of Pluto right now is just 1/100,000 of Earth's surface pressure.
Yeah.
And they measured this by sending radio waves to Pluto as the probe was passing directly behind it, and therefore measuring the distortion of those radio waves through the atmosphere, along getting those really beautiful pictures of the sun filtering through.
So super interesting. Like, it may be that this was just incredibly fortuitous, that we are actually looking at this planet in a moment of transformation. And who knows, what if this had not worked out? And we had not been able to send the probe at this time, and we had to wait another couple of centuries. The people that then would look at Pluto would see something fundamentally different and not necessarily even know that it's a different condition than what we would have observed if, you know, with New Horizons.
Yeah.
Which is kind of mind blowing, really, because this is stuff that happens over millennia. So to see something in that much flux is pretty phenomenal.
Yeah, of course, lucky for us, one of the coolest features of Pluto that we've observed so far is the direct evidence of the erosion of Pluto's atmosphere.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Pluto has a tail, which anyone who knows Disney is not surprised by. Because it's on every single one of the cartoons.
Go pun yourself until you are ashamed.
So Pluto does have an atmospheric tail. So the solar wind, that radiation, it impacts the atmosphere. Pluto does not have super strong gravity. That atmosphere is getting stripped away. And on the backside of the planet, you could sort of think of it. Imagine that you've got water that's hitting a round rock, and you'd see the water kind of move around that rock and then rejoin on the other side. That rejoining part, think of that as like the tail that's being pulled away from Pluto. That's where the solar wind has gone around Pluto and started to strip this atmosphere away. That's why you have the various instruments aboard the New Horizons to look for plasma and you know, indications of solar wind. And also measure this rate of the atmosphere being stripped from the planet. And it's pretty interesting. Also, we're seeing some new pictures of Charon, Nix, and Hydra. The photo of Nix shows, like, if you see the pictures of it, it's kind of this weird pink
kind of like
shape.
A jelly bean?
Yeah, jelly beanish.
Yeah.
Yeah, reddish pinkish kind of hue. But NASA does point out that the color of those photos has been enhanced. And Nix looks exactly like it came out of the sequence where the Millennium Falcon is going through the asteroid belt in Empire. It looks like an asteroid from Star Wars. And Hydra itself may actually be covered in water ice, which is kind of exciting.
Ooh,
yeah.
Yeah.
And yeah, we still have lots of things to ask ourselves, like, where is the heat coming from on Pluto?
Yeah.
Don't know. It's kind of cool.
Yeah, in addition to the other hypotheses I mentioned earlier, I was, again, reading about this in this science magazine. So radioactive elements inside planets can, of course, explain heat coming
up
geologically.
Yep.
But that's thought not to be the case for Pluto and especially Charon, just because they're so small.
That they would have radioactive-ed out already, right. If that's how you verb that noun.
Yeah, if they had it all, I guess.
Yeah.
Like they essentially, their batteries would be drained by this point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. So, of course, it turns out that they're much younger than we originally thought. Maybe that's the explanation.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it could be.
That's why we're looking. So, yeah, really interesting there. One other thing to mention is the fact that we don't have all the information because New Horizons is still sending it to us.
Yeah, and there's really quite a lot of it. We're going to spend the next several months, I think, receiving nitty-gritty little bits of geological data.
Yeah.
They kind of sent all of the big, interesting photos out first to be like, hey, look at this shiny thing.
Yeah.
Everyone be excited about it. And then it's going to be plodding through logs and logs and logs of data for a while.
And it's not getting to us quickly for two very good reasons. So first of all, we probably won't be seeing the last of the Pluto data until maybe December 2016.
Mm-hmm.
That'll be when we, by then we should have received the last of it.
Man, speed of light's so slow.
It's speed of light, and it's also the fact that they're using the equivalent of like a 1200 baud modem on the New Horizons, which is actually true. They're using a transmitter that has a throughput of between 600 to 1200 bits per second. So if you're sending something of significant size, it's going to take some time to get to Earth, not just because of the distances involved, because yes, as we've said, even light's going to be traveling, at a top speed where it's going to take hours to get back to Earth. But also because of the throughput, if a file is of a significant size, then, 4.5 hours after it's been sent from the probe, we start getting the first bits, and then we have to wait several hours for it to complete.
Mm-hmm.
So this whole process is going to take quite some time. And, the probe itself has a couple of different recorders on it, solid-state recorders, each of which has 8 gigabytes of storage space available.
And that might not sound like a lot of data, eight gigs, and these are modern times of having cell phones with a terabyte on them or whatever it is that people are walking around with these days. But in the terms of space exploration, it's really quite a lot.
Right. And when you factor in that you're only able to send it at 600 to 1200 bits per second, that takes a very long time to send that much information, assuming that you've even filled up the drive. You may not have, but still, it's going to take a long time.
Yeah. That might not sink in because you might not even interact with the measure bit in your day-to-day life.
Yeah.
Like a bit. What is a bit, Jonathan?
So a bit is 1/8 of a byte.
Yeah.
And then a gigabyte is 1 billion bytes. So 8 billion bits. Well, roughly speaking, because if we want to be really, really specific, then you have to start going like, oh, well, a kilobyte is actually 1024. But it doesn't – we're not going to get into those little tiny details. But, yeah, generally speaking, if you're talking about 600 to 1200 bits per second, getting through a gigabyte is going to take you quite some time. Yeah, it just makes me think back to my – early days of using a dial-up modem and connecting to bulletin board systems. I think it said something along the lines that it would take you several hours to download a standard picture. Like if you were using your phone with the same sort of data throughput and you wanted to access a picture, you would start and then maybe like 2 hours later, you might have a picture to look at.
I remember doing that in like circa middle school.
Yeah. Okay. Fine. For middle school for you. Yeah. Okay.
Oh, yeah. No, I remember when I was in like elementary school.
Yeah. Great. Yeah. Great. Elementary school. Fantastic.
You try to download a picture. It might take an hour.
Yeah.
But, then you'd print it on your printer.
Yeah.
And hang it up on your wall.
My favorite was when you would start downloading a picture and someone would pick up the phone line.
I needed this picture of Judas Priest. Why would you do that?
I'm not even going to be able to find that Sailor Moon comic again.
So the other things we might learn due to the New Horizons traveling around will be more information about some of the other moons of Pluto, as well as Kuiper Belt objects. They're going to try and have the probe fly by some Kuiper Belt objects and get a better look at those to get an idea of the composition of those objects. And then assuming the probe doesn't collide with anything or suffer any other kind of failures, it will continue
on its way. Get eaten by space monsters.
Yeah. Oh, those darn sandworms. Assuming none of that happens, it will just continue on its way and eventually enter interstellar space, following in the footsteps of Voyager 1. Which did that back in 2012, although we didn't get confirmation of it till much later.
Yeah.
So Voyager 2 still not in interstellar space yet.
So which is going to be the first one to reach Planet X?
Oh, by the way, this has confirmed there is no Planet X.
Oh,
well, unless it's like maybe what if Planet X is just on the opposite end of Pluto's orbit and further out? Well, then New Horizons wouldn't have any idea, right?
You know, I actually have heard, I think, people say it's possible for there to be larger objects way out there somewhere in the Kuiper Belt where we can't see it because it doesn't radiate or reflect enough light for us to detect.
And who knows? They might be right. It's just one of those things where, you know, we have certainly been looking out there, but if it's because they're so far away and they're large, but not like large in the sense of Jupiter large, they're not large enough for it to reflect enough light for us to detect easily. I don't see why that's impossible.
Yeah.
You know,
large and made of Vanta Black.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it could be that they just absorb light to the point where it's darker than what black is, you know,
like that
material developed here on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
But the
universe is a mysterious place.
It is. And it's getting less mysterious as we send more missions out like New Horizons. So this was really a lot of fun to look into. I mean, it was great to see the excitement in the general population as the images started to come back and we got our first real close-up look of Pluto. I know some people thought, oh, well, that's kind of sad. We've looked at all the planets now. Like, now we've got images of all the different planets. What's left? There's so much more left.
Oh, yeah. You can always send better cameras. You can always send more instruments. You can always go further out.
Yeah.
You can always land more stuff on weird stuff.
Like comets. My goodness, people. We've got so many other things we can learn about. So, and that's just within our solar system, let alone beyond it.
Yeah.
So,
do not worry that we're running out of mystery. That is a ridiculous fear.
It is an enormous resource that we have only begun to sample.
We're just wallowing in it.
Yeah. So, hey, if you guys want to wallow in other stuff, preferably topics about the future, send us some comments and questions and suggestions. We would love to hear from you.
Send us your rant about Planet X.
Yeah, that's or you can send that to Stuff They Don't Want You to Know. our email address is fwthinking@howstuffworks.com. You can also drop us a line on Twitter, Google+, or Facebook. At Twitter and Google+, we are fwthinking. Go to Facebook, search FW Thinking, we'll pop up. You can leave us a message there. We do read all of them, and we look forward to talking to you again really soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.